Okay, so I'm Mark Denham from University of Glasgow in Scotland. Strangely enough, I'm not actually going to speak that much about Folio. I'm really going to be talking about where I see the University of Glasgow Library, what it's going to be looking at in the future, and as a result, why we're interested in Folio. My job for the last 5 years has been quite different to what I've been doing up until then. Historically, I've really worked originally with the university as a system librarian. My background is in technology. I'm not a librarian. And it really focused on basic support and infrastructure. In the last 5 years, I've managed to convince the directors of the library that what we've not been doing is looking forwards. What we've tended to do is react to the immediate problems we have and make decisions almost, not quite, but almost on a day-to-day basis. Certainly, any planning is done on an annual basis. So for the last 5 years, what I've been trying to do is convince them that technology doesn't happen overnight, that there is a lead time, that we actually have to prepare for things. And so in that context, what my main job has been is to be going around and saying, if you always do what you've always done, you'll always get what you've always got. Because one of the biggest problems is convincing people that you can actually change in a way that isn't going to disrupt them entirely, that you can plan for these things, that they can be organized effectively, and it doesn't just happen and suddenly you come into work and it's a different desktop. You've never had any understanding of what's going to happen. And the idea that you can think in longer than a one-year time frame, which is what our budget year is, and that tends to be the thing that impacts on people's decision-making most, that you can make those processes easier by thinking about them before they're implemented. And in fact, if we look at the university itself tends to work on 5 years. And as I was saying earlier to Neil, we can't do even a one-week project in less than 3 years, because it takes 2 years to convince people that you've got a problem and 1 year to find the money, and then you finally get to do it. So to give you a bit of an idea of what the University of Glasgow is, this is the official picture that we're supposed to include in all presentations. I would ignore most of it. The key bit is we're very old. So what does that mean? Well, we were originally founded in I've not got my glasses on, 1451. We've only moved once. Now, I don't know about you, but I personally have moved about 5 or 6 times in my lifetime. And every time you move, you have a good clean out and you get rid of all the stuff you don't need and it gets manageable again. Well, the university's only done that once, and that must have been about 400 years ago. So we haven't had any good clear outs. And all the stuff that all the other bits of the university doesn't want anymore but might need one day tends to go either to the library or the museum or the archives, and we all three work together. In fact, recently the archives became part of the library. So it means we've got a lot of stuff. In preparing for this presentation, I thought, how am I going to do it? And one of the first things I did is I did an image search, and I tried to find an image for what is a library. Because one of the problems that we have, I think, by and large, and I don't suspect that that's the case within this room, but if you talk to most people within your institutions, one of the big problems is people don't actually really understand what is a library for anymore. They have certain habits, they have certain expectations, and I think some of our, particularly the academics, still think the library looks like this, that it's, you know, a place where books are held, that they're very difficult to get out, that we only lend them on payment of, you know, their soul, that we're helpful, but only so much. Now, just to bring you up to date, that's what our library looks like. And yes, it has a lot of books. Now, part of my job, as I said, is to look to the future. And as part of that, I don't really look at how things appear. I think about, well, what is it like? What other models can you use? So when I look at our library, I tend to see this. Because that is largely, for the vast majority of the people that come into the library, what it is really like. It's like going to the supermarket. Yeah. So for the vast majority of those figures that I gave you earlier about the number of undergraduates and postgraduates and staff and so forth, the vast majority of them are not doing anything particularly esoteric. It's like going to the supermarket. They're prepared in advance. They've got a shopping list. It might be called a reading list now, but it's a shopping list. They're looking for things that they already know exists. And in fact, they may not even bother checking the catalogue because the way that it's set up at the University of Glasgow now, they don't have to. What they will have done is gone into their course module. Their course module has a reading list. That reading list looks into the library system and checks where those items are, whether they're available on the shelf at the moment or not, and tells them. So they don't even use the catalogue. And they come with their little list, their printed list, hopefully, so they can remember where it was, which these days they might have downloaded actually to their phone. They come into the library, they go to the place that's marked, they pick up the item, they might read it in the library, they might take it away. They don't tend to fall across things that they aren't on the list. They don't use people to do that. They use equipment, whether it's the electronic services or equipment in the form of self-issue machines. There's very low level of human interaction involved. That's true whether it's electronic or physical. So, by and large, they seem to be quite happy. Now, one of the things that was mentioned earlier is the move towards electronic. Interestingly, we had a survey last year, and we found that amongst our students, not only do they still value the library as a physical space, rather than using PCs elsewhere, they would still prefer to come to the library, not quite sure why, to use a PC to search on the internet, because somehow there is a connection that says the library is the place to do that sort of work. But also, we have now seen a dropping off of the use of electronic resources, that certainly for undergraduates, the use of a physical object is very important to them. Having said that, all of that facility is, if not perfectly, at least reasonably well catered for with our current LMS. So we're not actually interested in replacing that LMS. We might want to tinker with it a bit. We might want to get vendors in terms of connectivity to make changes. But it basically works. We don't have to do a lot of housekeeping to it. It's all automatic. So why am I bothering to be here? I'm not really interested in a library management system at all. Well, the thing is that whilst I look at the library and I see a supermarket, what I also see are lots of little places that look like this. It might be that the library is a supermarket, but it's also a supermarket that's got lots of little speciality counters. And quite frankly, those speciality counters are not helped with the LMS at all. Now, our actual speciality counter tends to look like this. So it's quite difficult to see how it varies from the main library, but in essence, they tend to deal with subject or topic searching. They're not dealing with somebody that already knows what it is that they're looking for. They tend to get repeat customers. So once they're seen as an authority for information, that they actually know things, as opposed to simply being a vendor, much in the way that you might go back, and if you go to a speciality counter and you usually buy I don't know, a particular sort of salami, but you fancy a bit of a change, you'd ask the person behind the counter, oh, well, this is what I normally have, but can you suggest something that might be better in this particular circumstance? They'll give you some supporting information. That's what these information desks do. So there is this high degree of personal contact. And what we've found in the survey responses is that for those people that use these services, that's why they use them. It is that element of the personal contact, the fact that they perceive these individuals of having knowledge that they do not themselves have. And more importantly, that the electronic systems do not accurately portray. And so in this way, what we're finding is that the metadata that we're providing isn't enough for people to readily discover these alternative sources of information. So it results in this problem of hidden treasures within the library, that there is material that many people could be using and do not, because they're unaware of it, that the current infrastructure does not adequately provide for. And this comes about in two parts. Partly is, as I say, that the metadata itself is not necessarily within the LMS. It's too poor for what they achieve. So, for example, within our own context, there's a variety of things which we have put into the LMS, which, quite honestly, we did 15, 20 years ago. If we were to be doing those projects today, we wouldn't be putting them in the LMS. Because any attempt to put this information into the LMS immediately results in compromise. The LMS, certainly ours, is based on Mark 21. Mark 21 is very good, or at least adequate, at describing bibliographic materials, including serials. The further you get away from what you're wanting to describe, from being either a book or a journal, the worse it gets. So, in the past, we have put in rare books. Now, that seems to be a reasonably good thing. It's a book. What's the problem? The problem is that they are rare books, and it's no longer simply the fact that, well, this is a Principia Mathematica, therefore they're all the same, therefore this record is fine. No, I'm sorry, this is the Principia Mathematica that was owned by somebody that themselves was significant and made annotations in it, and in fact wrote half one of their critical papers in notes in the thing. And it's that information, not the fact that it's Principia Mathematica, that is crucial to whether somebody really wants to look at that copy as opposed to, say, a current facsimile folio copy, which purportedly has exactly the same information. So here, this is where a purportedly straightforward thing, the inclusion of information about rare books, turns into a nightmare, because much of this information, what has happened is, instead of it being put in structured form so that you can intelligently interrogate, it's been put in a three-page note, which means that in theory, yes, you can find the information, but in practice nobody does, because it's either entirely hidden from discovery, or the bit that somebody might be interested in is on the third page, and of course, as we all know, nobody looks past the first page, and therefore they miss it entirely. With these other cases, there's similar problems. So, for example, with DVDs, invariably within Mark 21, it's actually, you're hard pressed to discover that the thing you've got is a DVD. You're more likely to see that it says it's a video recording, because our cataloguers are very strict and they don't like bending Mark at all, and so won't use what people know but what the standard says. So if you go into the library looking for a DVD, you could have problems, unless you're actually going to physically browse the shelves. Or that you understand that video recording means something other than what you think it might mean. Therefore it could include a DVD. Similarly, for maps, there's equivalent problems. So all of these fit in the LMS, but they're not happy there. They're not easily found on the basis of the information that the people that are wanting to discover these items actually have in their heads as the bit of information that would connect them to them. Ironically, the only one that comes anywhere near being successful is the exam papers, which are just about to change and move out because the university has decided it wants to change from using printed exam papers to electronic exam papers, and therefore it's being wholly done differently, and it's now being taken under the wing of the management information people, and they're putting it into a totally separate system, and it's never going to come near the library again. So in a sense, that's a problem solved, but not necessarily in a way that the students will like. It gets worse if we look at other material that was never, ever considered to be put into the LMS. These either end up in silos of their own that don't readily incorporate into the discovery system, because despite what I say to various vendors and they claim otherwise, my experience is that discovery systems basically only like books, so you have to pretend that the thing you're describing is a book in order for it to work properly in the discovery system. Or if you look at large collections, what you'll find is invariably, instead of the detail and the richness of the information that you have in your collection description, which is in perhaps EAD, in a highly structured way, which can be interrogated efficiently and has depth to it and richness, what you get is one line, because the only bit it can cope with is the top-level collection description. So if somebody's looking for particular things, they won't find it unless they know that actually what I've got to do is write a much more general description in my search term, or think about the organisation that might have held this particular item rather than describing the item of interest. So as you can see from this list, we have a whole range of materials that most library system vendors assume libraries don't deal with. Now, this is in part because we've been a library for a long time. Some of these things will seem a bit odd. Why on earth has a library got a walking stick? Well, the library, even before archives was incorporated, had a special collections department. That special collections department started off dealing with what you might expect, like historic texts, emblem books, early printed books, all the sorts of things that people assume special collections would have. For reasons I have never been able to work out, in addition to that sort of material, the library special collections ended up holding the Scottish Theatre Archive. Not an obvious place to put it, but that's where it ended up. Now, that Scottish Theatre Archive has all the sorts of things you might expect on the basis of theatre. So it has play sets, it has documentation about theatres, it has posters, postcards, pictures of cast, all that sort of thing. But it also has memorabilia. Bizarrely, it has the X-ray of Harry Lauder's hand. It has his walking stick. It has his mother's iron kettle. Now, I don't personally understand how this happened, why it happened, or whatever, but we have got them. We therefore have a responsibility for ensuring that other people know we have got them. And therefore, we need a system which enables us to describe these things accurately enough that if somebody, for some strange reason, decides to check, oh, I'll just have a look at whether the University of Glasgow happens to have Harry Lauder's walking stick, that they discover that he has actually got it. Which then leads me on to the whole business about discovery, because even when we then try and incorporate this information into the current discovery systems, it doesn't work very well. It doesn't fit very well within the move towards using facets. There is not a facet for material type walking stick. It gets hidden away in some sort of general catch-all one for everything that isn't really describable as a book, of which there are rather a lot, and therefore it wouldn't actually appear on the page very readily. So we have all these sorts of problems about, well, you know, LMSs don't really do what we want. Well, we've made it even worse for ourselves, because not only are we interested in describing the objects we hold, of whatever sort they are, we got fed up, or at least our archive unit got fed up with people phoning up because they knew that the archive had the historic records, because they checked online and the Discovery system said, oh, if you want to find out who was a student at the University of Glasgow, then you have to consult this volume. Well, they really didn't want to keep having to go back to the volume. So they had a project, which initially wasn't, but became called the University Story, to take the actual information rather than the metadata. They wanted to be able to put up information from those reference sources to cut down the number of people that were phoning up and asking. And you just say, oh, just check the system. So initially, it simply took the records, the ledgers, and they sat there and they typed in everybody's name as, and when they had been at the university and what their degree was. And that's all it did. And then somebody thought, well, actually, you know, we could add on to that. We could put in other bits. Yes, they've been at the university, but not only had they been a student at the university, but later they came back and they were a professor. So and so. So we'll add that bit. So there was another project to add that in. And then somebody decided that actually, you know, there's a lot of other things. We could describe the buildings that we have, where they'd been. And so that was added on. And then there was somebody else had another idea and they added on those that were in the First World War. And, you know, what rank they were and what medals they won, which battles they'd been in. And that was added in. But all these separate projects, because of the way the university works, and they won't pay for full-time developers in the library, because, of course, the library doesn't really need any technological support, were all done on individual projects. And each project came in and would be one IT person plus various members of staff that would actually do the data entry. And of course, because we don't pay very much, each one really only had their own expertise, which meant that they did it their way. And if you didn't let them do it their way, there was probably little chance of the project completing on time. So just University Story, let alone all the other things we do, but just University Story has seen six different developers develop the project in different directions, in different ways, to different standards. So all these add-ons work together, sort of. But the poor soul who now has to support it has to have six different sort of ways of working in their head, because if you want to do a bit on this bit, it works like this, but this one over here works slightly differently. And from a user interface point of view, it also looks a bit of a mess. So recently we have this thing called the Chancellor's Fund, so yet another project funding. Yeah, actually, we put in a bid 2 years ago and got an answer back a year ago to say, yes, you can have money to bring it up to scratch. And of course, the university being the university, it wasn't really interested in the infrastructure. It only was interested in the fact that the website looked a bit old and tatty. And so what they were thinking they were paying for was for somebody to come in and just make the front end look nice again. And I'd said, no, that's actually the least important part of the whole project. What we really need to do is to work out not what we want to do today, but what are the possible things we want to do in the future, and build an infrastructure that's totally new, doesn't work at all the way that the current infrastructure works, absorbs the information from it, but works in a radically different way. So one of the first decisions we made was that we were going to use CDOC-CRM as the methodology for modelling information, because it's readily extendable, adaptable, and is designed for the heritage sector as a whole, and not just one little piece of it. We also realised that much of the information we had was not just of interest to us in the site that we were building, but was crucial to other parts of the university, and that they had information that we would ideally want to incorporate into our own site. So, for example, we now have an institutional repository. We have various research pages that tell us about what the particular activities of a given researcher is. And wouldn't it be much better for the university story system to be able to pass information to those sorts of things so that having discovered that, I don't know, Alec Baldwin has written a paper on, the coffee culture of Glasgow in 1982, that actually, not only has he done that, and you can see the other papers within their system, but you can then go out into the university story from that system and discover where he's been researching otherwise, where he came from, what other institutions he's worked for, and so forth. And vice versa, so that, for example, if you happen to be interested in, say, the Zika virus, as was recently, and you come into us and you discover that one of our researchers was the person that originally discovered the Zika virus, back whenever it was that he discovered it, and that that's been researched on the University of Glasgow for a long period of time. And here are the current papers that the current research team have just published, so that you've got not just the history, but also the current awareness. So from that perspective, machine-to-machine communication is infinitely more important. A key thing that comes out of all this business of project working is that all the interfaces are very different. So, for example, instead of a staff member that's been using one part of it being able to readily adapt to using a different part of it, it's almost as if they have to start again, because if they work in exactly the same way, they get a totally different result. Bizarre things happen. So a critical example is that some of the work that was done early on University Story, it assumed that people knew a lot more about HTML coding, that they would write correct HTML. So it just takes whatever you put in, because only people that know HTML coding would ever use the system. Later on, somebody realized that wasn't the case, so their input is a bit more robust. So if you write fractured HTML or you miscode things slightly, it says, well, I'll tidy that up for you, and it sorts it out. Or it will deal properly with entities. So what happens is that with the if you key in, if you're used to the one, the worst case, of course, is being used to the better one and then going to the worst, you'll suddenly find that you've typed something in and it looks right to you, and you press the button, and when it appears on the page externally, it stops after about the first line, because you've put something in and it just doesn't like that, and the rest of it just disappears. So there is an issue there in terms of actually being able to use a system that's consistent. And then the other big issue for us now is getting ready for a proper linked data environment. If you think about Mark 21, it's a bit strange to me, as a non-cataloguer, as a technologist, why did you ever have an authority system and then copy the data from the authority system into the record? It doesn't make sense to me, because that means you've now got multiple places of truth. And if you ever decide you made a mistake, you've got to change it all over the place. So for me, one of the key things is you have one place of truth. And linked data is part of moving towards that. So whatever thing you agree, and it seems to be that from a period of having one standard, libraries are now moving into, God, let's think how many different ways we can describe a book. So we've now got a plethora of standards all of a sudden, all trying to compete for the space. One of the key things for me is that whichever route you go, that it's got to work more rationally in terms of making use of this idea of linked data, or at least linkable data, where you say, I'm going to put this in one place, and if I ever have to change it, or if I have to add supplemental information, or if I have to add this is equivalent to this external record, I do it once in one place. I don't have to go do a search across the whole database, find everywhere it's used, find use some sort of tool for updating all of them. Or even worse, I check them individually as somebody mentions, don't you think that's wrong? And I update just that record without thinking about all of the other ones that also have that information in it. So for me in particular, and I think the University of Glasgow in general, the whole move towards linked data and cutting down all the issues about what is effectively a caching problem of copies being existing all over the place. So in case you don't know about CDOC CRM, this is what university story type material looks like in CDOC CRM. So what we have here is in the centre, you've got a person, Isabel Elder, who was a benefactor of the university, gave money to set up a chair of engineering. And as you can see, it all links out so that there is as much or as little information as you want. Now, I was at a linked data day recently, and they said, there's no such thing as a bibliographic record anymore. Well, the truth is, there never was. If you ever looked under the hood at the library system and how it actually stored that record, there wasn't a record. There was a bit here, and there was another bit of information somewhere else, and there was another bit of information in another place. And it was all behind the scenes put back together, so it looked as if there was a record. And in the same way, linked data can be approached in the same way. So if you really want, you could have a presentation of the thing that you think of as a bibliographic record. But behind the scenes, what will have happened is that the system will have taken all that information. It will have said, well, we're not interested in some of it. We know it's there. For some other purpose, you might be interested in it. But for bibliographic context, it doesn't make sense. It's not relevant. It's not in the standard. So we'll just pretend it doesn't exist. We'll just put up the bits that are relevant. And now I'm going to finally slide into Folio. So why am I interested in Folio? Well, first of all, I'm not interested in an LMS. I hope I've made that clear. I'm just not interested. It's too much work. Our sort of works, the frustration in it is not high enough for the level of work required to replace it. What I am interested in is a library services development platform that can deal well, and I mean well, not just adequately, but well, with all those, what you might call, delicatessen or boutique areas of the library that have always been either poorly or not at all dealt with in terms of integration within an LMS. Part of the key point of that is that you're including the information without compromising it. You're not trying to pretend it's something else. You're dealing with it as it is. You're trying to take all the information that you've got, not just bits of it. Another strong rationale that I really like, particularly having been at the Copenhagen workshop, was the fact that it had a very strong sense in which they were getting in experts to deal with the UX design and coming up with a standard that says, this is how it will work. Obviously, that's key from their perspective in terms of having this modular application development, but it would get rid of one of my big problems of every time you do a bit in the library that's not part of the LMS, you have to learn. And even if you use one, that's not transferable to another. In this, with a strong UX definition, you would get exactly that. That once you'd learned something and it worked one way, it would work that way with all the applications. Unless you get some rogue who decides to bin the whole thing, which we just won't have in the future. It's also supposed to work very well in a linked data environment. So that's the positive side. So my adoption strategy within this context is we have serious procurement issues. I don't know about Hungary or Czech Republic or anywhere else. UK tends to blame the EU for everything, including its own cock-ups. What we find is that in the public area within the UK, it's very, very hard to use a procurement process that means that you will end up with an open source solution. They're not built, and our procurement officers aren't readily capable of buying in solutions that are open source. They want a company to blame, is what it comes down to. Okay? So it just doesn't happen. The only way open source gets adopted within the university sector is as a project. It starts small, it becomes crucial, and somebody suddenly realizes. It always struck me as truly bizarre, because if you asked many of our university staff, particularly on the academic side, does the university use open source software? They might remember a bit, but they don't realize that the basic backbone of the internet is open source. DNS systems are open source. The vast majority of web servers that are used are open source. They've been using open source whether they like it or not. And yet still there is this problem with introducing open source. Again, I'm looking at the long term. I'm not expecting tomorrow to go back and pick up the current version of Folio and say, right, we're going to build everything in future on Folio as it is today. My time frame is anything between 2 and 5 years' time, which may or may not fit in with yours, I realise that. But what I'm looking for is making sure that the decision we make now at least moves in the direction of where we want to go and doesn't cut us off from what we want to achieve. And in a similar vein, what I'll be doing is making sure that whilst it's going to be further down the line, that it is still possible to get what I want when I reckon I'm going to be in a position to take it, rather than it not being possible because a decision was made in an earlier period that then means, no, you can't do that now, but if you'd have told us that at the beginning, we'd have done this slightly differently and it would be possible. There's nothing more frustrating than that. So, to re-emphasise, I'm looking for things that the current LMS doesn't do. So I'm not interested in the LMS bit. I'm interested in how can I use Folio to give a better service to those pieces of the library that are not well serviced at the moment. In the expectation it's going to take a little while. In addition, in the expectation that it's going to be people like the developer that's currently working on University Story, that in future what I'm going to be saying to them is, right, here is where you start from. You're going to be using Folio. You're going to be working to this UX standard. You're going to have to do this because we cannot any longer afford for the developer to be in charge of making those crucial long-term strategic decisions simply on the basis of, well, that's what they know how to do it. Now, that's going to have consequences. It means that instead of paying probably about two-thirds of the going rate, in all honesty, taking what we can, we're going to have to actually increase the amount we're prepared to pay for those developers. If we're going to be more restrictive about, they're going to have to work in a particular way. We're also going to have to factor in that for the majority of them, unless they've already worked for us, that they're going to need some familiarisation time that they wouldn't have needed if they'd been just allowed to get on with it. On the positive side, instead of them building an infrastructure and deciding all of these things, it's going to be in place already. So that then offsets the time it takes for them to learn the environment. That, in fact, the amount of project work that they have to do is reduced because it's reduced to just developing the specific application. It could well be that in future, in fact, that unlike what tends to happen at the moment, where we develop the application environment, we make sure that it's working, Then we get a load of people in. Because we can't afford to keep the developer on anymore, the developer's then gone, the cataloguers start cataloguing, and then we discover actually it doesn't really work. In future, what can happen in theory is that providing that the infrastructure already exists, we could have a very basic cataloguing tool, or indeed no cataloguing tool at all, but some sort of machine-to-machine transfer of information so that the developer actually starts at the end of the project. All of the data is ready. They then actually are working on real data instead of them guessing what the data might look like. So the prospect of success, I believe, can significantly increase. So finally, one day we might move to using Folio as an LMS. But that will only be because we've had it around for a long time. People have got used to it. That all of the issues about procurement have disappeared because we've already paid for the bulk of the costs in terms of installation, development, hardware. We've got the core in there, and all we are then doing is adding one or two more modules. And indeed, unlike previous procurements, where one day you were on, in our case, GIAC GLIS, and the next day you were on Innovative's Innopack, what you could do, if you felt like it, was to start saying, right, well, we could do it module by module. So we'll make sure that the data's cross-compatible, we'll move across the information, we'll do that bit first, then we'll move the next module, and you could take as long or as short a period of time as you need to do the migration. So yes, we may end up with Folio providing all of the services. So really what I've been trying to say through this, it's a lot of it is engaging with trying to work out what we want, giving that information to the Folio team. They don't always agree with us. I don't expect them to always agree with us. But if we don't, as I hope you will do later on today, say, this is what we want. This is how we see the future. This is what we think are the important areas that we need dealt with. If you don't say that, it definitely won't happen. If you do say it, then you might get what you need.
What would be the relationship between your current LMS and the future Folio?
How will they connect? The biggest problem is that the question was, how will the LMS and Folio connect? And basically, that's a limitation of the LMS. With us, what we can do is we can export some information. We're fortunate we're now on our third system with Innovative, so we're on Sierra. One of the things that they have done over the last few iterations is that they've made their systems more open. They're not as open as I would like, but they're a lot better than what they were when we started. So, for example, it's moved from being a truly closed box with very little in the way of connectivity to the outside world. You were basically limited to importing and exporting marked records. You had to originally make your patron records look like Mark records because it only understood Mark, and it would then use some funny stuff in the background to convert from Mark patron records into real patron records. We've got read access to the whole of the database as a Postgres database. We've also got an increasing list of APIs which allow us to get information out. We use Z39.50 still as a means of extracting bibliographic data. And we also have batch jobs which run that extract the MARC data, both from the main bibliographic and the serials information, and export that. So we can get information in and out. It depends on exactly what information you want to look at. It's not ideal, but it does work. And going forward with Folio, one of the things that I want us to do is to look at how we can incorporate into the MARC records on the main system key points so that we're not just relying on either the OCLC number, which doesn't exist for all the material we hold, but for a lot of it, because it's not all, that's a problem. The other key record indicator is the actual inbuilt record number. That's a problem because only the system knows its own inbuilt record number. So we tend to rely on others. It varies. So, for example, with serials records, you could use ISSN, but what we found is that that's not very consistent. We've got some material that has upwards of 10 or 11 different ISBNs attached to it. There's a mountain of issues, particularly around trying to discriminate between the physical and the electronic versions. So it's patchy. It would depend on what exactly you wanted to do, how well it would work. I know that's sort of gone round the houses a bit, but I hope that's answered the question.
I'm very much interested in this CRM thing. Do you really expect that Folio will be able to store and manipulate CRM statements?
I come back to my final bit. One of the difficulties always with these sorts of projects is that you have one group of people that are discussing things at a high level, and they all say, absolutely. And then you have another group of people that go off and actually do the work and produce a product. And it's making sure that there's a good connection between what people say they're going to try and achieve and what people actually do. So at the minute, I can't answer that question, okay? Because it hasn't happened in terms of there isn't a product for me to say yes or no, it does what I want. I'm not personally expecting to see that version. If I'm optimistic, it's a year. Realistically, it's probably 2 years. I think there are others that come on after me that are going to be in a much better place of saying to you, is this actually going to happen or not? So hopefully by the time we roll through all of these, you should have at least a partial, if not a good answer.